Happy Thanksgiving to our Canadian listeners and to everyone else. Hey, welcome to Monday, because it's the movie breakdown, so we've got another episode for you. And because we're recording this from Canada, it's Thanksgiving time for us, so we've got a special Thanksgiving episode. We're calling this the breakdown of the things we're thankful for in movies. So we're going to be looking at five different things that we really appreciate and we're grateful for that comes out of movies. For me, it's a wonderful film critic who sort of shaped my career and shaped this podcast of Roger Ebert. We're also going to look at how films sort of immerse us and make us see a different view and a whole bunch of other stuff. I'm Christopher Spicer.
And I'm Scott Martin. And the first one that I'm really thankful for, and this is something you've probably heard us talk about over the years and how much we love it when movies do this, and that's when movies take us and just like rip us out of where we are in life at that moment, and they take us somewhere else, and we are just absolutely immersed. I mean, it can take a whole bunch, this idea of a movie, of a story, grabbing your attention, and I'll be very honest, you know, I deal with some mental health issues, and I'd say the last little while has been extremely difficult, but, you know, we, Chris and I, just on our previous episode, if you will recall, was our favorite comedies of the 2010s. And I was amazed. Like, I knew that I liked a bunch of those comedies. And when I went back and watched them again, I was amazed with just how many of them made me just completely forget anything that I was stressed about, anything that I was worried about, money problems, self-esteem, doesn't matter. You know, you start watching a film and all of a sudden it's like you don't even notice that you are no longer paying attention to those things that, you know, you deal with 24 hours a day that can, you know, keep you from sleeping and keep you from wanting to eat right. There's just such a power in that experience when you are just vanished, you're gone from your present life. And it's, I mean, a lot of times too, when the movie's done, it's not like you're just thrown back in it. You still have a bit of a reprieve when that movie's finished because you're sort of on a high from that experience. And I think there's another neat aspect to the being transported aspect of movies, because I think back to childhood, and you know, I Chris, when I hear you talk about stories of you know, Everett and Danica and how they play. When you've got that imagination, when you see a movie, yeah, you get transported during the movie, but it doesn't leave you. It comes back and, you know, you've got 45 minutes until dinner and then you're transported again and you're looking for, you know, a sacred idol that you're, for some reason, you think is proper to steal and take to a different country and sell it instead of, you know, keeping it in with the country that has it as part of its cultural heritage. But for that 45 minutes until dinner's ready, that's who you are. Or you're Elsa. Who knows? But, you know, when a movie really grabs us, it allows us to exit life for a bit. And whether that's while watching it or, you know, when we're younger, you know, forget that. Even when we're older, I mean, I drive a car for a living. I'm a courier. And you know, there's some movies that I just think about as I'm driving. And so you get pulled back in it. And to me, that's one of the best things I can be thankful about with storytelling. The fact that somebody can, you know, those things that you, like, you can try saying to yourself, I'm not going to think about that anymore. I'm not going to think about that anymore. But then someone comes along with a story to tell, and all of a sudden, you don't even have to try to talk yourself into no longer thinking about those things. You know, movies can really, really help us look at life in different ways, but movies can also give us a break from life in different ways. And that's one of the most powerful things I think about storytelling, and that's definitely something that I'm thankful for.
Yeah, I've got a lot of fond memories. I think one of the reasons that I love the movie theater so much and I've missed it this past year is I have a lot of fond memories of a kid going to the movie theater with my dad and going to that dark room and basically just being transported and captured into this new world. I was Luke Skywalker for a few hours. I was Marty McFly having to race back into time. I connected with these characters up there on the big screen, and as a kid, I would come home and I had notebooks and notebooks of different stories expanding upon those worlds, and I'd go in the backyard and play them again. So, yeah, I love being transported to these new worlds. And one of the things that I think movies have been always really good for me is not only an escape, not only a transporting while I'm watching it, but I find they've always fueled my creativity. They've really, I think it's because of how the medium is, because it's so visual, because there's music, because there's so many elements that they use to craft this storytelling, because it's performances, all these things. It just allows my brain to go like crazy, and it just gives me different ideas of stories I can tell. And this was a thing I did as a kid, but even today, I find like I'll be done with a movie and start thinking of a different version of, like something like the Halloween or a different take on something like Guardians of the Galaxy. I feel it fuels my creativity. I'm still transported to these worlds, and now it makes me wanting to sort of think of different slants, think of different forms. It gets me excited about, oh, what else could I do with this genre? Like a Knives Out, like this great idea. I enjoyed it. I was immersed while I watched it. But when I come home, I think, so what other different takes could I do on the whodunit? And so I feel like movies has been really great at fueling my creativity through all my life. And I'm so happy now to see my kids, because like you said, you nailed it. They are totally that way. I mean, after Everett saw The Kid Who Will Be King, he tried to turn all the different spoon, like tried to make multiple spoons at home for months. Like he was totally trying to do these magic tricks. And Danica has been Elsa for ages. They even played Animal Crackers, that horrible movie, for a few weeks. Like whatever they watch, their imagination goes like crazy, and I can relate to that because I was like that as a kid, and today I still am. Like you said, it's just a different outlet. It now comes through writing. I don't go in the backyard and play by myself anymore. Though sometimes I do have an excuse, and I do it with my kids.
Well, that's the perfect thing. You've got that way to allow yourself to do that again.
Oh yeah, no, we've hunted for treasure from, we've stolen lots of treasure from different native groups.
Repatriated it back to a fancy museum.
I don't know if my kids ever quite know what they do once they get the idol. They have it, and then usually then they've moved on to like being on a planet or something.
So they don't know about the middleman yet.
No, there doesn't seem to be too much. They're not getting wealthy off this quite yet. They're more in it for the adventure and battling the snakes and jumping over the crocodiles and watching out for the giant boulder. Though Tanika has basically been telling everyone who will listen that her favorite movie is Indiana Jones, even though she's never seen it. And I've let her teachers know she hasn't seen it. And then when I call her out on that, she goes, "I know, but I know I'm going to love it."
That's awesome. So she just picks
'Cause
that up from her brother then.
he, yeah, ever loved Indiana Jones so much. He's played Indiana Jones so many times that she's decided if she's going to be a cool kid in 2020, you got to be down with the
That's
Jones.
right. Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, and like I said, we've talked about it on this show before. I think this idea of being transported, it is good for an escape. I mean, I do struggle with like some mental illness stuff too, and some hard times. And so I definitely like movies as that escape for a little while. But there is that other element for me where I just feel like it's been really rewarding of how it kind of wires my creative aspects, which I'm sure is something you have as well.
Oh, totally. Especially when you're watching a movie that does something in a way that you haven't thought before, or does try something new, and then you just, it's like this injection of energy that, okay, you know what, there's still rules that can get broken. There's still new ways of doing things, and coming from a like thinking of your own creativity, you start to, I don't know, see possibilities in what you can do.
Actually, that's a really good point. And I think that is one of the things that maybe has changed. As a kid, it would be the worlds and the adventures that transported me. Now it's less so those and more when I see a form of storytelling told differently. When I see nice guys that blend noir with action, with comedy. When I see the way that Knives Out told a different take on whodunit. When I sort of see these different forms of storytelling, something like A Star Is Born, where it's both romantic and uplifting, but also very melancholy and sad. Seeing how they tell those stories and how they play with my emotions, that's where I'm transported now, because I start thinking, well, how can I tell stories that way?
Mm-hmm. Indeed. And before, just when you said melancholy and sad, would you say it was melancholy and infinite sadness?
No, I would not. Oh. I would say that's a great Smashing Pumpkins album, but, but I would not say that about A Star Is Born. But I get why you're trying to go there, because yes, it was an awesome Smashing Pumpkins
album. It was an amazing album. That's one of the best albums when you just like play start to finish with the two discs. It was just what an experience. But I'm glad you brought
up storytelling.
Well, that's the thing, right? I mean, that's the great thing with the different mediums. And sometimes it's, yeah, like when you talked about A Star Is Born, that made me think of music because of how effective and raw the music was because of the, you know, the attention to detail they did with it and recording everything live. It's like when things are done differently, when you connect to that element, it sinks you deeper in there. Like when the first scene where I think we see Bradley Cooper's character playing the guitar they got the huge crowd, like they shot that so well, and because of how well the music was recorded, it really, really felt almost like it was a concert doc.
Yeah, no, it was something really special seeing that on the big screen, seeing that in the theater. And you're being transported is very close to sort of what was my first pick of what I'm thankful for. And that is the shared experience. And when I speak this, when I'm talking about the shared experience, I do miss the movie theater. I am talking, there is that aspect of being able to sit there in a room with a bunch of strangers and connecting to a movie together, laughing together if it's a comedy, squeaking if it's a horror or whatever it could be. There is that element, and there is that element of watching a movie with my kids and sharing something from my childhood with them and then being excited and watching something with friends. But what I'm really talking about, the shared experience, is closer to what Roger Ebert once said, and that was how movies are empathy machines, where when a movie is done well, it is the best way for you to connect with the character, a character that you normally would never connect to, a character that you have nothing in common with. And movies, because it being a visual medium, because it can do settings, because it can create this whole new world, you have the opportunity to be in the footsteps of a character you normally wouldn't be. You have the opportunity to see what it's like to be a black woman in the early 1900s with the color purple. Or you have the right to see what it's like to be a gay right activist politician in the 1970s with Milk. Or you have something where, like, a free black man who has now been captured as a slave again with 12 years a slave. You have this opportunity to go into eras that you've never been before and for a few hours see what it's like to be like that. Well, what it's like to be black or Hispanic, what it's like to be gay, what it's like to be from the 1800s as a teenager or as a woman, what it's like to be as a genius artist, musician who has people who are guilty of you and wants to take you down like Amadeus, what it's like to be, I'm hopefully never going to have to start a war to avenge the death of my wife, but for a few hours I got to see that through Braveheart. And so you get to do things that you normally couldn't do. Part of it, I think, is the empathy. Part of it is like something like Do the Right Thing, where I get to see that other side. I get to see what their life is like and what it's like to be oppressed. And like Boys of the Hood was a very eye-opening movie for me as a teenager. Boys of the Hood was a very powerful film because it's a life I've never had, a life I will never have, but I got to see the other side. But on the other side, it's also just your chance, and this is where it's kind of close to Scott, of being the hero you never would be. I'm never going to be Bruce Willis. I'm never going to be able to take down terrorists and forget to wear my shoes. I'm not going to be able to do those things in my life because I always remember where my shoes are and I usually have socks on. But I'm not going to ever be John McClane. But for 2 hours, you can be that character. And so sometimes you get the shared experience of being a hero. You get the shared experience of being a Jedi. But like I said, sometimes the more powerful things where you can be a true political figure. You get to, for a while, sort of understand Malcolm X and his challenges and who molded him through that movie and the great performance of Denzel Washington. And I think movies are so great because when you have really good directing, when you have really good music, when you have really good set pieces, when you have great performers like a Sean Penn or a Whoopi Goldberg or a Denzel Washington or some of these, or all these different people I've mentioned, when you have these great performers, for a little bit you feel like, I understand this. And there isn't really any other medium where you can really understand the other side. And so that's the shared experience that I think is really powerful and I'm grateful for.
It really is. And then you've got the people who play with it. Like I think of Scorsese and Francis Ford Coppola with Crime and, you know, tempting us at the like throughout the movie of like, you know, is this your fantasy? Is this kind of life, you know, or is this your escapism now? And then all of a sudden throwing that around and sort of showing the horrors of those sorts of lives, using, I think that desire for some sort of escapism and then showing us, you know, real people's true experiences and the horrors that come from certain decisions. And yeah, you get people that sort of twist and play with it like that, and that really, yeah, throw the entire thing off.
Well, that's a really cool thing, is when movies are done well, you can have the empathy, you can understand the experience of what it is like to be someone who's been oppressed and stuff, like with someone like the Color Purple or 12 Years a Slave, like that thing, you get that. But at the other side, you get to see the darker side. Like you said, you get played around a bit of like, what would it be like to be a criminal? What would it be like to be a gangster? And you see that, and you see that glamour. But little bits throughout the film, you do realize, I'm kind of glad who I am. Like, I'm glad I'm not in this world. And that's why I've never understood when some people, like, they think of some like a Goodfellas or a Godfather or even Wolf of Wall Street, of how it glorifies that life. And I feel like if you've really been watching this movie for 2.5 hours, do you really want that life? Because I sure don't once it's done.
Well, that's absolutely the thing. And while we're sort of teased and played with in films like that, then the empathy comes at the end. Is, you know, who do we feel sorry for? Who here is the victim? Who here is the, you know, it was society playing a part in all this? And all of a sudden, then that feeds into the shared experience with friends and whoever you've seen it with, because now, you know, you can't stop talking about that experience that you had when you got to see into the life of someone who you'd never really think otherwise.
And that's the thing. That's why the shared experience is in all different ways. You have a shared experience with the movie. You have a shared experience with these characters. But like you said, then at the end, you also have this opportunity to discuss these things we've learned, discuss these perspectives. How did I interpret this? How did this experience go for me? And you could share it with your friends. You could share it with your family, the people you saw. Or sometimes when it's in a theater, I know I often did, you get a vibe of how the people around you are connecting with.
There are some movies where that's totally the case. Like you really do feel some sort of energy or some sort of understanding that everyone is completely invested. And, you know, I think of you know, certain films that that like the Blair Witch Project was, that was a communal experience with the crowd. Yeah. At the cinema, something that pretty much nobody in there had ever seen before, a type of storytelling that no one's ever experienced, and it was good, and you could tell that there was this tension amongst everyone, and that really sort of amped everything up. That took the frights in the films up. It's like what you were sharing physically with those people amplified what you were seeing on the screen.
When you saw the Blair Witch Project, by the time you saw it, was it pretty clear by that point it was fiction, or was it still some people thinking this was real footage?
Some people still thought it was real footage when I saw it, yeah.
So that would add the tension too. Like that's one of the smart things that they did there is I think that movie, you can't really understand how scary it was to see it in 1999 because there were so many people who are watching this thing and thinking this happened to someone a few years ago.
That's right. That's right. And as, excuse me, as much as I love it, it's one of those films that's not going to age for do well for a modern audience that's seen everything that it's inspired. Because if they look back, unless they're really keen on, like, unless they're storytelling nerds and want to see something that's different, if they're just looking for jump scares and all that, it's not the film. But back then, yeah, there was, I mean, I'd say about 50% of the audience knew, okay, no, this is a movie. They wouldn't be putting a snuff film in the theaters. But then you had the other 50%, and I think they really wanted to believe it was true. They just,
yeah,
it didn't matter what people told them. Entertainment Tonight could have interviewed some of the actors in the movie, but they wanted to believe it was true. And you know what? I've had times like that with films too, where I just wanted to believe something about it.
I think two modern movies that I can think of where I definitely felt like the audience was completely sucked in all the way through was A Quiet Place, where that was probably the quietest the theater had ever been for a movie I'd seen. Nobody was checking their phones. Nobody was talking. They understood the experience of what needed to be done for The Quiet Place to work. And another one where I really felt the audience was sucked in because they cheered and they gasped every time they were supposed to was Get Out.
Nice. Two that I didn't see. I should also mention, this was only a few years after Blair Witch, but and it's not remembered. You know, I don't think many people even remember. Oh gosh, how did I all of a sudden forget the name of it? Nicole Kidman, The Others.
The Others, yeah.
The Others was a masterful theater experience.
Others was a masterful theater experience that got ruined for me because you saw it and you liked it so much you wanted me to see it with you. And so we were going to go. So you were going to go a second time with me. And you did, and we did see it a second time. But right before we left, we watched Mad TV, and the gag in one of the sketches was to spoil the ending of The Others.
That's horrible. That's horrible.
Yeah, no, I remember looking at you desperately, and you're just like, yeah, I'm sorry. You still want to see it? I was like, yeah. But I think I'd lost what was a great ending because I expected it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
it's still a really good movie, and I think we've talked about putting it on this show about 150 times, but I still don't think we have.
We haven't. It's never popped up on a streaming service that we've had.
Oh, I guess that'd be the reason then.
That would be the reason, because like if there's any type of film that I really, really want to podcast about, it's movies like that create that experience, that creates that magical moment in the theater, but then is just sort of forgotten to time. I mean, even if you look back at the metrics of The Others, the box office, like I think its diminishing rates were so low, and I think it even increased a few weeks in, which you don't see. So, I mean, people were watching it, but nobody remembers it.
Well, Richard Roper does. I remember Richard Roper, I think he did a list of his 10 favorite horror movies of all time one Halloween, and The Others was on it.
That's good. I'm happy to hear that. But sometimes horrors are such a great shared experience, like in that theater, that tension. That and comedies, horrors and comedies.
Yeah, no, definitely. I think both of them, because they're such visceral mediums and they're so much about sometimes going at our raw basic instincts. There's just that visceral experience. I think both horror and comedy at the two extremes are a great shared experience.
Mm-hmm.
And horror is one of the ones that when I watch a good one, it follows me home because I walk my dogs at night. And I remember It Follows. That was a scary dog walking evening.
That movie, I tell you, you walk, especially at night. Just, is there anybody following me? Anybody at all? No. That movie aroused such a suspicion of the people around you. It never had a sequel. Oh, wait, segue. Something that I'm grateful for. Thankful for, in the spirit of Thanksgiving. And some people may roll their eyes at this one. Sequels. Yes. Here's the thing. It seems to be nature in a business that if people like a product, you want to package it up and sell it again. Hollywood's a business. I'd like to say that it's a creative outlet and it's all about storytelling and this and that. But without the money aspect, we wouldn't get any stories. And so therefore, movies are going to be made to try to recapture things. And you know what? Sometimes I have no idea why a certain movie, The Babysitter on Netflix, it has a sequel. How? The Kissing Booth. What the hey?
The Kissing Booth soon gonna have two.
Is two? That's right. And so I mean, there's something like we cringe at the idea of sequels. There's a lot of times where we talk about how we want standalone films and everything, and we do. We honestly do. But if you're able to do something with that original story, if you're able to find a new place to go, if you're able to continue characters on or introduce new ones, then sometimes sequels actually are just an amazing thing. You know, you look at the John Wick series of movies. Sequels were good. Now we look at Taken. What did we learn from Taken? Sequels bad. Some of my favorite movies out there are sequels. You know, I think about a movie like Aliens. Just an absolutely brilliant film, and you know it never would have happened if there wasn't that first one. It will, of course, obviously, but there's something when a movie's done right, and I'm not talking Ghostbusters 2. I'm talking about those times like when James Cameron returned to Terminator. I mean, the Terminator, the first Terminator, it was a fairly low budget film. It had some neat things. People criticize it for, you know, looking dated when some of its special effects. And I kind of take offense to that because, I mean, they built a robot in 1984. Let them have their time. And anyways, James Cameron returns to that and he is able to create a Terminator experience that all of a sudden the masses get to enjoy. He takes something that, you know, some of us were really just geeked out about, and all of a sudden, you know, everybody is able to come in because it's such an open experience for a bunch of people. There are so many times where movies have really shocked me, where I thought there's no reason a sequel should ever be made. You know, Wrath of Khan. That's one of my favorites. That is my favorite Star Trek movie of all time. And if people were just looking off of, you know, should they have gone on? Should they have made another movie after the first film? And, well, they did. And look at what we got. I think that the thing is with sequels is they have to be and they have to be allowed to be their own thing. Because if you look at something like The Wrath of Khan, or if you look at Aliens or Terminator 2, these movies are all they have something different from the originals. They either go a different direction, they have a different feel. They're sort of more epic and sweeping, or they're more, you know, close and closed in. There's a lot of sequels. I mean, gosh, you know what? For the longest while, I thought that the idea of the movie Psycho 2 was the stupidest thing I'd ever heard of. Why would you take one of the best films ever made and make a sequel? Psycho 2, really? Yeah, it was good. And I'm not going to say in any way, shape, or form was it better than the first one, but you watch it and it's its own thing and it's an engaging story and you're hooked. Let it be. So sequels are one of those things that can really, really turn out some of the worst stuff that we've ever seen before in our lives, from Jaws 4 to Brahms, the Boy 2. We have seen some awful, awful, awful stuff because of sequels, but we've still, and they're not in the majority, but we have gotten some absolutely amazing films because people have come up with ideas to take those stories further.
Yeah, I think that's the big thing is, I mean, you and I have bemoaned sequels, and we've definitely got really annoyed by movies that seem to be built for the whole sake of having a sequel, mm-hmm. or they have this very jarring ending, this cliffhanger ending, and that stuff annoys us. But you nailed something in that when sequels are good, when they work, it's when that they do something different. It's they do something new. They do a fresh take on what was the original movie. I mean, the first Alien is almost this kind of closed ship, bump in the night horror picture. The second one's like a war movie, Aliens. And then Terminator, the first one, again, it's sort of a stalker slasher type thing. And the second one is this big sweeping action picture. It's something very different. And not only that, but they changed the mythology and they added on to T-1000 and they create a new Terminator. And even Predator, the second Predator, I haven't seen it in ages. I remember being disappointed, but I want to give it another chance because it's very different than the first one. The first one's set in the jungle, and the second Predator is this urban film with this cop that's trying to figure out these murders and then realize it's the Predator. And so even with Predator 2, even if it's not being good, it tried something different. And with John Wick, I would say they're all similar movies, but each one builds on the mythology. That's the interesting thing, is you learned more about this underworld of assassins. The second one is so fascinating because you learn that there's so much more. And then Godfather, the second Godfather is almost like a prequel in some ways. You learn more about the father and you go back to old Italy and how it got built up. And then Empire, very different movie from the first Star Wars. Wrath of Khan, very different movie from the first one. So even though I'd say probably more often than not, I roll my eyes with sequels. When sequels work, they're really magical. And it's when there's a creative reason to return to it. It's when a director wants to go back. Or in the case of Gremlins 2, the director doesn't want to go back. And they basically try to kill the franchise and create something gloriously different.
Which, I mean, that is a sequel that is absolutely unique from the first film.
And apparently the rumor is Joe Dante did not want to make a sequel. The studio forced him. He said, okay, well, I'm going to kill it. But that doesn't mean it's a bad movie. I've gone back. You maybe go back and realize it's great. It's just very different.
Very, very different. I mean, we look at, you know, the wonderful Die Hard movies. And, you know, honestly, I could live without the second Die Hard.
It's more of a retrend of the first.
Yeah. But then you get to the third one.
Buddy action.
And it's a lot more fun. It's a lot more upbeat. I mean, there's still a lot of tension. There's still thrills. There's, you know, chasing and stuff like that happening. But the entire vibe of it is different. And it was its own thing. And it was really a lot of fun.
Yeah, no, I love Die Hard with a Vengeance a lot. Like, you talk about a film that I feel like doesn't get enough praise. I feel that's a really underrated movie. I really enjoyed Dark of Vengeance, and it's the same thing you're saying. It's because it does something different. Another movie that I think it's really good too, and it's because it did things a little bit differently. I really like it. I think a lot of people may disagree with this, but Nightmare on Elm Street 3, Dream Warriors.
Oh, that one's fun. That one just sort of had its own...
It's different.
It's like I think they realized with the second Friday the 13th that, okay... We may have lost our way a little. And then it was, I don't know, this, it's like, okay, teens versus Freddy. Let's like have basically just this battle between them. And it's not so much Freddy just, you know, in the fourth one, I think Freddy just steamrolls everybody, stomping all that stuff out. But in the third one...
It totally destroys the goodwill of the third one.
Oh, yeah. Especially, like, the cockroach... Because
I think the Dream Warriors all get killed off the first 10 minutes in the fourth one.
Because the fourth one's with the cockroach motel, isn't it? That is some of the lamest stuff since Friday the... Or since Nightmare on Elm Street 2.
Yeah, no, I think the fourth is probably one of the worst. And the third... It's, if I had to pick my favorites, I would go the original New Nightmare and then definitely 3.
And that's the thing. Without sequels, we wouldn't have got the New Nightmare, which was, I mean, if you want to talk about, once again, just the idea of going somewhere with a fresh story idea, that one was just, that was a blast.
You know, it really was. And the Indiana Jones ones, some of those, the ones minus the refrigerators, they're really good, and all for different reasons. Either a different genre, or you get to build on the mythology. I mean, probably one of the movies I was most excited to see in my lifetime was a huge sequel, and that's Star Wars: The Force Awakens. And that was a glorious experience. And then one of your favorite movies is also a sequel, Mad Max: Fury Road.
I was going to bring that up. I was also going to bring that up in the final segment, so I'll leave that one for the final segment.
Okay, now I hinted it at the beginning of the show, and this is one that I brought up Roger Ebert a lot on this show, and there's a reason, because he's an incredible influence to me, and he is, I think, my connection to why I love movies so much. I was a big fan as a kid of the Siskel and Ebert show. I watched it almost every single week. I loved seeing these two guys war against each other. I liked the fighting, but I just liked the analysis. It gave me a different perspective on films. They taught me that films can be discussed. Films can be analyzed. And what I also learned through them is you have different opinion on films, because they would disagree. And so there was these two guys who were thoughtful and very smart, and I learned more from their disagreements in a lot of ways. And you know, the Siskel and Ebert show really influenced me, because this entire podcast basically follows in the path of the Siskel and Ebert show. If you watch an old episode, you'll see that how they did the reviews, how they review movies, is very similar to how we do it. And so I've been heavily influenced by it. I would, if you people, there's probably some people listening to this that know very little about Siskel and Ebert. SiskelEbert.org is a nonprofit site that is basically trying to keep all the episodes. It has tons, over 200 episodes on there, archived. So if you want to check out some episodes, go to SiskelEbert.org, where they are essentially trying to archive these things. I think Disney may officially own it, but they are not paying attention to it. So these people now are basically trying to keep it going. And so the show was influenced a lot and really got me interested in film criticism and that idea of talking about movies and analyzing movies and discussing movies and be able to see different opinions. But then when I got older, I started hunting down old Roger Ebert reviews, and Ebert's always the one I've connected to the most. I think it's because he's always been someone who's reviewed from the heart. Like I said, he's the one that sort of had the phrase, movies are empathy machines. He's always been about sort of that emotional aspect. And so I've really enjoyed reading his reviews through the years. And I think one of the things I always respected about him is how much he really didn't give a shit about what other people thought about the movie he was reviewing. I mean, he gave a positive review to Zookeeper. He gave a positive review to Paul Blart. And he gave negative reviews to Texas Chainsaw Massacre and Kick-Ass. And in all four of those cases, he went against the consensus. He had views very different than what the majority of critics did. So he never really cared about what the other critics did. He didn't care about the Rotten Tomatoes score. He had his opinions. He did not like Texas Chainsaw, but hey, he likes Kevin James movies. And what I always respected about it, when you read those reviews, is you understood his side. You knew that he wasn't trying to troll people. He really explained it. So even though I disagree with him on all four of those movies, I respect how he went about explaining it. I respected about how he came to that. He used his film knowledge. He used his film history. He used all those aspects to explain why his opinion mattered and why it had value. And I also just think Roger Ebert, he was a great man in that he helped a lot of younger film critics, James Baradelli, Nathan Rabin, who are bigger critics today, Matt Zoller-Zeitz, another big critic today. They basically say that he helped their career. He gave them their shot. He helped them break out. And so I liked the compassion he had for people. I think he was a great human being. And I just loved how he... like I said, approach movies. And so it really has taught me that movies are not objective. Your opinion on movies are not an objective thing. It's subjective, but you still need to be thoughtful. You still need to think through the views that you've come. You need to know all about the things about camera shots and acting and music and all these elements of how it works to sort of justify your opinion. And so Roger Ebert's been a huge influence on my writing style. He's been a huge influence on the fact that I decided to become a movie critic for several years now. And all that has really been sort of based off him. And so I think that, I'm very thankful for him in that way. And I always try to find a shot where I could shout him out and think that he's one of the all-time great film critics. But I think as just a listener, one of the things you can get out of him is that idea of the importance of dialogue, the importance of discussing movies, the importance of allowing opinions to be heard, the importance of being open-minded. He was all about seeing different movies and championing these small movies. He was a great champion for films. He had Ebert Fest, a yearly festival where he tried to put in these movies people didn't hear about. He championed foreign films. He championed these lesser things. And that's something that I think is great too, is just challenge yourself. Try different films. Be an Ebert.
Yeah, I didn't watch them weekly, but it was something that I was always very interested in. it is... you know, doesn't sound like a typical teenage boy, but I was always interested in it, that there was movies out there that they were discussing that I'd never heard of. You know, growing up in North Bay, you know, what are the main movies that come out? And that's what you know about, and that's what you hear. And to the youngins, this was before there was ever something called the internet. And so, you know, there was no... there's no saying, well, you just had to look for it. Well, if it's not there, if you can't see it, it's not in the North Bay Nugget. They're not writing about these things in the North Bay Nugget. So Siskel and Ebert...
their show is how I learned about tons of movies.
Yeah, and so when I'd see their show, I'd start realizing, well, there's some very interesting-looking movies that I've never, ever heard of. And... you know, they'd be talking about maybe a genre that I didn't think I liked, but the way they were discussing the movie made it sound intriguing, made me think, okay, it may not be my thing, but I kind of want to give that a shot. And I don't want to take a swing at movie critics, but this is a bit of a swing. Some of them seem to like to write in a way that makes you feel inferior as a reader in how they use words, how they describe things. And I don't think that's cool. Like, you may, you know, maybe, you know, be true to yourself, but sometimes it honestly feels like that's how they're like swinging their writer's penis around, showing how big they are because of the words they use and how, you know, they just blow your mind. You didn't need to be any kind of English major or anything to gain something from Siskel and Ebert. When they reviewed things, yeah, you know what? They would use words that I wouldn't, but they didn't string them together in ways to make them sound, you know, very, very intellectual and stuff. They just used them in a proper form where you figured out the context, you knew what they were saying, you were able to understand their criticisms, you were able to understand their praises. They spoke in a way that you didn't feel inferior. Like, I mean, you still felt inferior in the fact that, okay, these people see things a lot more critical and a lot more brilliantly than I do, but you didn't feel like you're an idiot because you're not intellectual enough to hear their thoughts.
Well, I think someone like Ebert, like, yeah, he was incredibly intelligent and he was a genius writer. He was a really talented writer. But I think he wrote it in a way, and I think just because of his sincerity and the fact that he seemed like this person that you could connect to, that rather than often reading his stuff that I feel inferior, I felt inspired.
Yes.
I wanted to write like him rather than, oh, I couldn't be like him. It's like, I want to be at his level. I'm aiming to be as good as he could be rather than, oh, I don't know what he said.
Yeah. And I don't think that's as common now as it was, but I'm sure it still exists.
You know, there's definitely good film critics. The three that I mentioned, Nathan Rabin, James Bradley, Richard Ropert and Matthew Zoller-Seitz, I think are good critics, are worth checking out, as well as Christy Lemire. I think they're good. The thing about Ebert, though, and what I think is fascinating is he was the first film critic to ever win a Pulitzer Prize. And he was the film critic of basically what was considered the blue collar paper of Chicago. The Chicago Sun-Times considered more for the blue collar. So he wrote for the people that weren't necessarily the white collars. He didn't write for the rich. He wrote for the 9-to-5ers, the people working in the factories and stuff. But despite that, he's the one who won the Pulitzer.
Yeah. And I think that's, I mean, to me, that's my big takeaway from Roger Ebert, was the fact that I felt I could learn, and it didn't feel like there was intelligence being lorded over me, because, and back then, I shouldn't, you know, Leonard Maltin was good too. He wasn't,
yes,
he wasn't bad or anything. I respected him a lot. But yeah, there was this idea that these profound thoughts that I'd never think to apply to a movie, they could be discussed and wielded, but in a way that I understood, and I never felt like they were trying to push themselves above their audience.
Yeah, and I think one other thing that I really appreciate about a Roger Ebert, one is he really made me learn that art criticism in itself, like film criticism in itself, is art. It is entertainment. He was very witty. He was very smart. He was very insightful. And his reviews were entertaining, sometimes more entertaining than the movie they're reviewing. He knew how to entertain and grasp you and tell a story through his review. And that's the thing that I liked, is his reviews aren't necessarily about check marks. It wasn't, oh, I got to get the acting, I got to get this, I got to get that. He just told what connected with him. He was telling a story. He did not have to hit all those beats. He would hit a few of them, but it was for what would explain his own experience. And I think that's something I learned a lot about him, was not to bog himself down of like, oh, this has to be structured a certain way. I mean, one of his reviews, he wrote it from the perspective of one of the characters in the movie. Like, he tried creative things. He tried different stuff. And in the end, he was really entertaining. Yeah, he was a great man. I really, really, he's just one of the ones I really wished I ever got to see in person. But my film criticism career, well, one is in Brantford, which is nowhere near Chicago. And second, it sort of started right before he passed away.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Did we review the documentary about him on the podcast?
We did.
That's
Life Itself.
That's right. Life Itself. You mentioned about him not showing you don't have to hit the check boxes. Honestly, when we started this podcast, I did not know how to approach how I thought about a movie. And I literally thought that, okay, I have to hit those check marks. And if I do that, then I've properly discussed a film. But then, I mean, I know you know, we'd talk about a movie and you'd send me a link to Roger Ebert's review on it. And having read a lot of his reviews, you start to realize, okay, it's not about hitting the checkboxes. Your review is your experience. What happened when you watched that movie and that's what you write about? Yeah, you know, it's important to mention who's in it and, you know, that it's a horror and, you know, it's not Paddington 2. But what was the experience? And that's more the important thing than anything else. And that was a big eye opener for me.
We probably could have saved a lot of time if our review for Devil's Due was just, it's not Paddington 2.
We could have saved a lot of time too if we just decided to write that review without even watching the movie.
Yeah. So, well, what movie was it? Justice League, where you wrote a review without seeing the movie?
Yeah, I believe so. I think it was Justice League. Yeah.
And you want? And then I went to see it, and then you asked me how close was I?
Yeah, I was going by. You know, Zach. I know. Whedon took over, but I thought there's going to be a lot of Snyderisms in there. So,
and I'm pretty sure there was. We talked before the podcast that there's. We have reviewed probably over 500 movies now, maybe even close to 1,000 now. We've been doing this since 2013, so we've reviewed a lot of movies and discussed a lot of movies. And so there are movies that I have blank spots for. There's movies where I look on my chart, my database, and like, what is that? And while I'm well aware of what Justice League is, I can't really tell you what happens in it anymore.
I can't tell you the plot. I know that there's a villain called Steppenwolf. I know that he had these really silly looking henchmen.
Yeah. Okay. I agree with you that I remember them being silly looking. But I don't remember what they look like anymore.
No, I actually, like 2 months ago, I was so confounded with the fact that I remembered that they were silly looking, but I couldn't remember what they looked like, that I did a Google search of, because I remembered they were called parademons, because I already had to search them once. They look a certain way in the comic book, and that did not translate into live action very well at all. That move, oh, yeah. I couldn't tell you the story if you asked, what's the biggest plot point? Superman comes back. That's all I know. I don't know who actually ends up kicking Steppenwolf's butt. Wait. Was that the one, or was it Batman v Superman where it was like, oh, they're heading to the warehouse section. So glad.
No, that's Batman v Superman.
I'm so glad the
I
working
actually remember
day.
That one better.
I'm so glad the working day's over and no one will get hurt.
Oh. Yeah, they had to throw that in because of the criticism of Man of Steel.
It wasn't just someone mentioned that and everyone kind of like, hey, yeah. Like, everyone, or not everyone, but I think we even mentioned it and we hadn't heard other people talk about that criticism. But it's true. You're watching it thinking, how many millions of people are dying right now?
Yeah, no, it was a definite criticism. What I had an issue, though, is it was a factory. It was the factory region. It was the industrial region. I don't know, maybe Gotham works differently than Brantford, but most factories have night shifts.
They do. Or there's still people populating the streets. It's not like, oh, hey, it's 4:30. Everyone's now gone.
Oh, man. Well, Zack Snyder, I mean, he's going to correct it all with his cut of Justice League,
which has always existed. The Snyder cut. He's just putting it together, right? Like that's all he's doing because it always existed.
You know what the Snyder cut and Justice League has had a lot of?
What's that?
Marketing.
And this brings us to the final thing we're thankful for. And once again, just like sequels, you may be thinking, well, that's kind of weak sauce. Marketing?
Yeah, you've got some controversial ones.
Yeah. Marketing? What the heck? Here's a question for you, Chris. Does your excitement for a movie start the moment that the opening credits come up or the studio's name flashes? Is that when your excitement begins?
No, my good sir. We've already mentioned a Star Wars Force Awakens. My excitement for Star Wars Force Awakens starts when I found out there was going to be a movie called Star Wars Force Awakens.
Absolutely. And then what comes, we've got that general movie news that you hear. And then all of a sudden creeping out onto the internet or exploding, probably more like exploding in the case of The Force Awakens, would be a teaser trailer. Or if I recall.
And that was huge because I remember I was so done with Star Wars after Revenge of the Sith and after the prequels. I was like, I don't want to see another Star Wars movie. I'm done. And then when Disney bought it, I was intrigued. When Force Awakens came out, I put it on my most anticipated, but I was still sort of nervous. It wasn't until that first teaser trailer that I felt the goose pimples, when I felt the adrenaline, when I felt the butterflies, where I was all in.
Yep. And you know, you think of what happened there. Look at, I was so against the idea of the Hobbit movies. I thought it was the stupidest idea. And I, you know, you see the movie and then, you know, you kind of left wondering, was it the smartest idea? I guess people got employed, but
people got paid.
Yeah. But I'll be honest, when the first trailer for The Hobbit came out, I was thinking, no, this looks good. This is a reason to go to the movies. When you have a trailer that can all of a sudden just sum up something, that can give you an experience, give you a little morsel of something, even if you think it's the dumbest thing they've ever done. Mad Max Fury Road. I thought, why? Okay, Thunderdome, never really got into it. And here they are years later making another Mad Max. Not sold. Trailers come out, honestly, not sold. However, those trailers wore you down. The more you saw those trailers, the crazier you got as a viewer. And then all of a sudden, you're watching a movie and you're thinking, I really hope the Mad Max Fury Road trailer's in this one, because the style of the movie was quite different. The feel of it was quite different, and so that trailers needed to sort of get you in the mindset of what you need, you know, prepare for. When we did last week's episode talking about the best comedies of the 2010s, we discussed with some of those films the job of the marketing people. How do you take a film with a, you know, an out there idea, with a very outlandish sets and stuff like that? How do you convince people that there's a context to this, and how do you convince people that, you know, they're going to easily accept it? Because, you know, when you see these things and you see trailers, something like the Grand Budapest Hotel, and you see the set, you could think, okay, this is kind of a silly movie. However, when you sit down and start watching it from the beginning, you're introduced to that world and it no longer seems silly. So the people who are marketing some of this stuff, these people, they've got to be brilliant. They've got to be geniuses, and they can be. And not just for movies that are great. Black Mass, I can tell you, I remember the first time I saw a Black Mass trailer in the theaters. Holy crap, this movie, I have to see it. I absolutely have to see this.
And I was the same way. The Black Mass trailer, I remember, got me really excited. I was like, oh, Johnny Depp's back. It's going to be one of the best movies. I was very much anticipating another trailer that I know that was really successful, but unfortunately the movie was disappointing, but I went very exciting, was Blair Witch, which I'm talking about, the more recent one, Blair Witch, No Project.
Yeah, the Adam Wingard one.
And I think that was part of it too. I mean, that, and again, that's all the marketing, is it had the trailer, but on top of that, it knew that people who are horror fans know who Adam Wingard is.
Yeah. Absolutely. And there's something that that happens when you've got that excitement, because then you start counting down to when the movie comes out, right? Like, the marketing doesn't just let you know something's coming out. The marketing starts the experience. the marketing can get the adrenaline, can get the goose pimples, can get all that going, so that not only are you going to see this movie, you're going to see it opening night. You're going to go and you're going to tell your friends, and you're going to want all your friends to come. And so the experience, after, like, outside of just the movie news, the experience can start happening once the marketing comes out. And yeah, it may seem like something that's you know, all business and all that, but it's what gets us going. It's what gets us excited. It's what makes us mark the dates on the calendars. And it's a very important part of the business. And when it's done right, another part of marketing, I should say, trailers that don't give away everything. Like when we went and we saw This Is the End, the fact was, half an hour into the movie, I realized, I think I've seen every single thing that was in the trailers. And then you realize you've got this entire film stretching out in front of you that you have no clue what it's about. So there's a lot of levels around good marketing. And yeah, it gets you geeked. It gets you pumped. It gets you talking about things. And you know, it's an art. I call it an art form. And it's something I'm thankful for.
No, it is an art form. A good trailer is a masterful thing because it gets you excited. A good trailer is a thing that gets you excited, that gets you anticipating the movie, that gets you understanding what it's going to be about. It gets you sort of proper expectations. It gets you set up. And it's an art form. It doesn't spoil half of the movie. I think it's unfortunate that modern film journalism has been all about basically being a marketing machine for big studios, where they've made the big news about trailers, they made the big news about the latest casting stuff. And that's not journalism. That's just basically listening to what the studio gives you. You're basically just becoming part of the marketing machine, which is unfortunate. And I get there is some film critics that are really annoyed about that aspect of it. And I think it has lost... sort of, we've talked about this too, about how it's lost the art of talking about movies after they've come out, because we're just all about what's going to be the next big thing. So I get that. But at the same time, I've always loved trailers. When I was a kid, I wanted to get to the movies earlier because I wanted to see all the trailers. I love a well-made trailer. I like getting excited. I like finding out about new movies, which you don't necessarily find out anymore because of the internet, I know about every movie that's coming out. But as a kid, that's when I learned there's going to be a thing called Gremlins. That's when I learned there's going to be a thing called Ghostbusters and Back to the Future, and I got excited. And so I always have a soft spot for a good trailer. A trailer that I think is excellent. There was a movie. It was a movie by the MCU that, even though I was a comic book collector, I never read this comic book. I knew nothing about it. It was a little movie called The Guardian of the Galaxy. When that trailer came out, that was my introduction to The Guardian of the Galaxy, and I instantly knew this is my jam.
That trailer was really good for a few reasons. Number one, it made the movie...
Because you had no interest in it before that.
I had no idea what the... There's a little raccoon and there's a Groot? Is this the first movie to have a Groot? Are they common in Marvel? If you see a Marvels, are they going to have a Groot? Like, I didn't know anything. And I don't know if I was won over the first time I saw it, but I think the second time, for sure, I was very excited about it. And the great thing about it, about that trailer, or the series of trailers, was not only did they build interest, but they properly conveyed the tone of the movie. You knew exactly what you were getting into. Same with Deadpool. Deadpool was brilliant. That was, if you just, you know, forget the trailers, look at the entire marketing campaign for what Deadpool did. That was brilliant. That was some serious, serious creative stuff. One of my favorite marketing campaigns in the last while, for sure.
Yeah, Deadpool right away let you know this is going to be fourth wall breaking. If you hadn't read the comic books, you would know, oh, this is a guy who talks to the camera. You knew it was going to be goofy. You knew it was going to be in your face. Guardian of the Galaxy, you knew it was going to be more of a sort of 70s campy B-movie version of Star Wars with a big rocking soundtrack. Like, they put those things in there right away. I think those are two of the smartest, most brilliant marketing campaigns in the last few years, was Guardians of the Galaxy and Deadpool, without a doubt. Both of the Deadpools are really smart. I like both the movies a lot, and I think the marketing campaign is almost as fun as the movies.
Which is
not saying a lot, because Deadpool made my list last week.
and I mean the that's the thing though, the marketing was amazing. It was really brilliant stuff. Like it was, he was sprawled out on a all sexy like on a rug in things, and like it just. It was wonderful because it came out on Thanksgiving or not Thanksgiving, Valentine's Day. Yeah. So they went with that angle, which was amazing. I have to say, you know, I bit the excitement bug with the teaser trailer for the Batman. They made a trailer for a movie. I think they've only shot 20% of it or so when they released the teaser, but that got my excitement going.
Oh yeah, no, that's a really good teaser. That's how you do a teaser, because it tells you very little, but it gets you hooked. I feel like nowadays, that's what I want. I just want to see the teasers and then see nothing else. Mm-hmm. Just give me a taste of what you're showing. That way, usually the teasers are good at not giving me any plot. I don't need plot. Just give me a little sampling to get me excited.
Just show me the world, and then yeah, let me experience it. Yeah.
Yeah, no, for sure. So, you know what? It's Canadian Thanksgiving, so we would love for you guys to tell us, what are you thankful for about movies? Do you agree with us on our picks? Or is there other things that you would love to talk about? You can do that. We're always open for a good old discussion, and you can do it by email at themoviebreakdown@gmail.com. Or if Twitter's more your thing, then do it there, at moviebreakdown1. Or you can do it on our Facebook page at The Movie Breakdown. All those places, we are active. And we lately, I've been getting some great questions and some great interaction with you guys on Twitter and Facebook. Keep it up. I love doing that kind of thing. And then as well, you've been listening to this podcast, but where have you been listening to us? Maybe on Stitcher, CastBox, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music. Or anywhere, basically, nowadays, where you like to listen to your podcast, we are there. So please subscribe to us on one of those ones. Please rate us. Give us a 5-star review. That helps us in the rankings. It helps us expand. And while you're at it, use those social medias to share us with a friend, to let people know us about us, and so that we can get more movie fans down with our stuff. And then if you like my stuff, well, you can also read my stuff over at the International House of Spicer, chrisspicer.blogspot.com, where this month I did a little hype piece last week. I am still going to do review every single MCU movie. I am still going to review every anime Disney feature as I had planned, but October's going to slow down a bit because October I'm going to review some horror movies.
Yeah. It's Halloween coming, and horrors come with Halloween, and Halloween-themed movies come with Halloween, and so there's lots to get excited about. We have, coming up on next week's podcast, Hubie Halloween. This, if you're like, wow, man, I can't wait for the next Stephen Brill-directed Adam Sandler movie, because I was going to say Adam Sandler movie, but honestly, Uncut Gems was a brilliant, brilliant film. This sucks.
Happy Madison, Adam Sandler.
Thank you. But this sucks. How can somebody so talented churn out such, like, uninspired stuff?
Well, next week he's doing a voice.
That's right. Yeah.
He's doing a voice. I've seen the trailer, Scott. If you were like, oh, man, like, it's been Sandy Wexler since I've got an Adam Sandler voice, you get one in Hubie Halloween. He's playing an outcast.
He's playing an outcast.
He yells at some point.
Oh my gosh. He probably yells at a kid too. And if you're thinking Sandy Wexler, yeah, hey, Stephen Brill directed at Sandy Wexler. So we're on the right path here. Things are going to be awesome. I want to be surprised. Adam Sandler is so talented that you don't know. Maybe we will be, but I don't think this is going to be it. Also,
but we do get it's Halloween. It's time for a thriller, a scary movie, and we got a good one.
Yeah, probably the biggest thriller. Has there been a bigger thriller since The Silence of the Lambs?
Yeah, I don't know. That's a hard one. Straight up kind of thriller in that level, it's going to be hard to compete. I mean, the only thing that really pops in my head is something like a Zodiac, and that's, it's not quite the same.
No, this is one of the biggest thrillers ever. This movie changed the pace for what thrillers would be, thrillers and horrors, because I think some people like to conveniently forget that some of their favorite movies can be classified as horrors. This movie really changed the trajectory of the 1990s as far as what thrillers and horrors would be like. What an impactful film. What an amazing movie. And I've been excited ever since I found out it was coming on Netflix, coming back to Netflix a few weeks ago. I've been excited. So we're going to be talking some Silence of the Lambs.
Yeah, no, it's definitely... what some hold up as one of the all-time great thrillers, and we'll be talking about that. We'll be talking about Adam Sandler, and we'll be talking about so much more.
That's right. And so you are compelled. You are compelled. You're compelled to join us next week. Please do. And once again, happy Thanksgiving to all the Canadians. I'm Scott Martin.
And happy Monday to all the non-Canadians. I'm Christopher Spicer.
Goodbye.
Bye, everybody.